This is the Killer Innovations Podcast with Phil McKinney. Keep in mind that the information and opinions expressed in this podcast are Phil's and Phil's alone, and they don't necessarily reflect those of his past, current, or future employers. Now, here's Phil McKinney.
Welcome to this week's podcast. I have a special treat this week. I've got Jeffrey Moore joining me today. For those of you longtime listeners of the podcast, you know that Jeffrey previously was on the podcast a number of years ago. Most of you know him as being the author of the best-selling book, Crossing the Chasm. He's actually written six books, and I can be one to attest that I've actually read all six of them. Crossing the Chasm, Inside the Tornado, The Guerrilla Games, Living on the Fault Line, Dealing with Darwin, and his more recent book, Escape Velocity. Welcome, Jeffrey, to the podcast. Really appreciate you taking this time to join us today.
Oh, Phil, it's good to be back, and it's good to hear your voice again.
As I was preparing for this interview, I noticed an interesting term or tag that people have applied to you is an organizational theorist. Now, I have to admit, that's the first time I've ever seen that term. Is that how you think of yourself?
Well, no, but to be fair, I think what it relates to, and it's something that we'll probably get into sometime, is in the latest work around innovation, what we discovered is that the organizational dynamics in a large enterprise and how they've been blocking innovation is something we've been very familiar with ever since the Innovator's Dilemma. But a lot of my work now is in helping organizations actually reorient themselves to become more innovation friendly. And so that's probably where the organizational theorist stuff comes from.
Well, first off, I want to congratulate you. You got the third edition of your book, Crossing the Chasm, out, came out in January. So what's new in the third edition?
Well, it's the same playbook with all new players. So the principles of Crossing the Chasm, particularly for B2B businesses, which is kind of what it's always been its sweet spot, they really haven't changed for high tech. It's the chasm problem is still there. The adoption life cycle still plays out pretty much as advertised 20, 25 years ago. But it's a whole new set of players. And so there was a whole new set of readers who would say, well, I'm having trouble relating to the book, the entrepreneur curriculums. You know, these are young people. They're going, I don't think I know these companies. And so what I did was I just went through the book and I updated all the examples so that they refer to companies that have come to prominence in the last decade.
Well, I don't know, Jeffrey. I think that is that saying that you and I are getting old now when the readers of your book don't recall those companies?
It does. I mean, you know, I did it once. You know, I wrote it in 1990. I did it once in 1999, so you would have thought. But you'd be sort of shocked at how many companies that were perfectly relevant as examples in 1999 are like, nope, not part of the landscape anymore. Do you remember a company called Sun?
Yes.
Do you remember a company called Netscape? AOL? I mean, you know how it goes.
Yes. Well, take me back. You wrote the book in 1990. What was the catalyst that really was the impetus back then that got you to write the book? I know you were ex-Regis McKenna, but give us a little bit of background on what was the catalyst? What was the aha that caused you to kind of to write that first book?
What happened was I was at Regis McKenna, which at the time was actively involved in the marketing. It was the premier high-tech marketing consultancy of the era. And so you saw a lot of companies. And we kept on seeing this phenomenon of these very exciting companies. They'd get these fabulous launches. They'd get unbelievably great press coverage. We'd say, this is the next Intel. This is the next Apple. And then they kind of go off the radar. And after a while, it's like, well, what the hell happened to these guys? And so there was just this kill rate of really exciting companies. And so we began to look at it, and as we peered into the situation, we discovered the chasm, this thing that, you know, the early adopters will love you and give you lots and lots of support, but the mainstream market has a very different value system. And transitioning from the early market to the mainstream market turned out to be very tough, particularly for an engineering-driven entrepreneur.
And so, when you think about the 1990, you know, time when you wrote the book and your most recent updating in the third edition, is there anything that's really changed about that from the problem space? I know you updated it with new examples, but is the problem space still the same?
Well, it's interesting.
Or have you seen
I would say Yeah, I think there's two major things that are different. The first, the big aha was in the first decade of this century, we had this huge explosion of consumer-based IT disruption. I mean, it was technological, but it was in the consumer space. Crossing the chasm is not a particularly good model for consumer markets. And so what it required us to do is go back and spend some time with those entrepreneurs. And so there's an appendix to this Crossing the Chasm edition called The Four Gears. And it's a model which is designed to say this is how the technology adoption plays out in a B2C market where, frankly, you don't need a whole product. You can just deliver the offer, minimum viable product, the lean startup model. Guys like Eric Ries and Steve Blank have really been championing this very effectively, and I needed to bring that into the portfolio. So that is one thing that was very different, because there was a whole group of entrepreneurs who thought, well, Crossing the Chasm must have been about some other era because it doesn't apply to us. What does apply to us is the B2B. In the B2B world, you do have to build an ecosystem of partners. You do have to create a whole product. It does require, there's a lot of inertia to overcome. So the chasm model really does apply there. I think the biggest difference there is that we have so much more infrastructure available to us in this decade than we did two decades ago. So as a result, you can kind of, like with information as a service, software as a service, platform as a service, that stuff, you can get into the game with a lot less capital than it required. So it's a little bit shallower kind of getting through, but there's still that inertial problem of trying to get the market to a tipping point where it commits to your disruptive innovation and people, you know, start marching in your parade.
Yeah, and I think you're talking about things like software as a service and infrastructure as a service, et cetera. I remember my previous role, I had some rogue engineers on my team who went out and used their own personal credit card to set up a prototype site at Amazon on the servers there without any going through a PO permissioning or anything like that. So it was the availability of infrastructure is very freeing, but can also be somewhat disruptive to the more traditional organization or enterprise from the standpoint of control. You end up with a lot of rows.
And by the way, now we're now touching on, I think, this really, maybe the final difference and kind of a key theme that's dear to you, both of our hearts, which is I think that the large enterprises, there's so much more technology in the 90s was largely brought in by very small companies who were highly disruptive, and they went public, and the companies themselves became large. So, you know, Apple became Apple, and Tandem became Tandem, and, well, a decade before, HP became HP, and, you know, Intel became Intel, and Oracle became Oracle. In the current era, the large companies have such a broad footprint across the globe that a lot of the things are is, you know, WhatsApp becomes Facebook or YouTube becomes Google. So you get acquired. And then you have the issue of how does the acquired franchise deal with the disruption of the acquired, how does the acquiring franchise deal with the disruption of the acquired business model? And that, as you know, is a big, we call it sometimes crossing the chasm inside the belly of a whale, because the whale is trying to digest you as you're trying to cross.
And you may not like it. You may not like the experience. But this ties in, if I get this go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think one of the things, though, that if I get, let me see if I get this quote right. If I recall correctly, you're quoted in a couple different places talking about really about the shift in the VCs. And one thing I didn't mention is you are a partner at venture partner at Moore David Dow Ventures in the Valley. And you talk about that there's been this VC shift from scale to liquidity, right? Does that drive any change in the thinking on within these enterprises as far as that the VC shift?
I think it's interesting to watch, and in particular, I think it happened under the pressure of the B2C market, because the B2C things it's a little bit more like a hits business, and in that world, you know, you try to capitalize on your one hit by getting acquired, because frankly, getting hit after hit after hit, as our friends at Candy Crush, you know, those folks are discovering, it's hard. Yep. And so now I think with genuine B2B businesses, it still should be about scale, and it still should be about, you know, long-term value creation. Because once you build an ecosystem around a technology, it's going to be there for a long time to come. So
yeah.
Building the ecosystem is the challenge in crossing the chasm. And once you get it incubated and then moving, you've got an asset I personally think you ought to stick with for a decade or more.
A lot of the listeners of this podcast are individuals within organizations who are trying to be that innovator, that change agent, and they constantly run into, you know, what I have tagged as calling the corporate antibodies, the parts of the organization that just get in the way of really how do you take good, great ideas and actually allow them to be transformative inside of an organization. And you work with a lot of the CEOs and the boards of the leading companies in the Valley and also around the world. Is there a change in the thought process at the CEO and board level about how they're thinking about innovation now versus, you know, what it was, you know, 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, this is where the organizational theorist stuff might come into play. What's happened is, this is a reckoning that they put off for a while. They're realizing, look, we don't succeed at this. I mean, if you say, well, how much R&D do you think IBM plus Intel plus Cisco plus HP plus Microsoft plus have spent over the last 20 years to get into the next big thing? And then how many of these companies have successfully brought on a genuinely new franchise, as opposed to something incrementally improving an existing franchise? And the record is astonishingly small. I mean, it would have been just fine until Apple then added 3 net new franchises in less than a decade, which just infuriated everybody, because prior to that you could say, well, it just can't be done. And then Jobs does 3 in a row, and they think, well, that's not fair. So the question, I think what the boards and the CEOs are going now is saying, look, if we cannot onboard the next big thing, then basically we're a one life cycle company, and we have to solve that problem. So the difference now is, you know, I think the innovator for a long time was frankly a lonely voice in the corporation, because the corporation said, we know better than you, and our established businesses, operating margins and gross margins and blah, blah, blah. And they'd pull out any number of financial facts, and they'd say, look at these financial facts and look at your paltry contribution, and why are you even deigning to come to our table? And the answer is, well, because these new things are going to change the world, and if we don't do it to ourselves, somebody's going to do it to us. And that's now happening enough so that, you know, Google represents an existential threat now to Microsoft, and Amazon is an existential threat to Walmart and to various folks. And so you start saying, well, whoa, okay, I guess we have to get better at this. That's the difference, I think, now. And so now I think there's some really serious thought from the top down about how could we reorganize and reconstruct the corporation to be more innovation friendly, to allow these things to onboard and get to scale inside our ecosystem.
So is this a recent shift, or has this been underway? I mean, you know, I get emails and, you know, instant messages and Skype calls from my listeners all the time with regards to the frustrations they're getting ready to go pitch, you know, their CEO. So the Valley guys obviously get it, but is this still kind of in the early, the CEOs and board waking up, or do you think it's becoming?
Well, it's not so much the waking up. They've known they've had a problem. The truth of the matter is Clay Christensen rang the warning bell in 1995. That's when he published The Innovator's Dilemma. So this problem has been on the books for 20 years.
Yeah.
So you can't really plead ignorance. But what you could plead for a long time is there's no known solution to this problem. And what I'm trying to do, and it's not just me, but the work that I'm specifically focused on, is saying, so let's deconstruct why this happens over and over and over again, because it's not ill will. It's not lack of ambition. So what's really going on? And what you discover is that the established franchise working at scale has got a very well-tuned ecosystem. It knows how to, if it's a cut hardware, they know how to manufacture, they've got the supply chain, they have distribution, they have customer support, they've got the sales compensation worked out, everything's working great. Now, somebody comes up with a cool new business and it's got a different business model, it's very exciting, and for a while, you know, it's small enough and you can kind of contain it and you can keep it in a skunk works and you can let it grow, and everybody's very, very enthusiastic about the business. But sooner or later, you have to scale it by essentially bolting it into the infrastructure of the established franchises. And you get an impedance mismatch. So the established franchise is older, it's more mature, it's got a set of metrics it knows how to run by. The new guys do not have a very different dynamic and a very different set of metrics. And so what you realize is this is an unnatural act. And the fundamental insight we've had in the last decade is two things that big businesses have not done that are causing failure that you, if you stop doing, your chances of success skyrocket. The first is the CEO and only the CEO can sponsor this thing, and they have to sponsor for 2 to 3 years. This is kind of what Steve Jobs made very clear, and Bezos has made it very clear at Amazon, because the CEO has to force the connection of these two objects, and they initially want to repel each other. And you have to say, you have to overcome that repulsion and get them together. You can do it, but you can only do it if with the CEO's power. If you try to say an executive vice president or a senior vice president is going to do this, they don't have enough power to re-engineer essentially the performance engine of the company in order to absorb their new business. The second thing we've learned is you can only do one at a time. And so this is the place where the CEOs really, I think, are going, oh. Because the CEO has always said we need two or three or four, this is a high risk, you don't want to put all your eggs into one basket. It turns out it's such an unnatural act and it does such violence to the corporation that if you try to do two at the same time, the corporation will I don't care if you're the CEO, I don't care if you're God, it just won't happen because it's just too much disruption for the enterprise to absorb and continue to operate. So the notion that it has to be sponsored by the CEO, and there's a bunch of techniques they can use, but the first key is you've got to be sponsored by the CEO, and you can only do one at a time. That, if you just took those two rules and you kind of went back over the last 20 years, most CEOs would admit, well, I violated one of those two rules every single year that I was a CEO.
Yep. So in the case of, you know, I'm all for the CEO sponsorship. You know, I've seen it in my previous life, and now in my new role as a CEO, I kind of look at myself and go,
yeah, it's dude.
I'm the problem.
You the man.
I'm supposed to be the innovation guy, and I'm the problem, right? yeah, I've had this realization, right? what is interesting, though, is your point about only doing one at a time, right? Because in the innovation game, right, you know, everybody plays the funnel, right? So I start off with 10 ideas, and I start whittling it down. Is your argument that when I'm getting down and I said, okay, I'm going to – this thing, the one idea that I am really going to scale, that is just the one idea. You still got to have the funnel. You got to be fielding lots of ideas.
Well, here's what is – my belief is that it's not a funnel. It's an hourglass. In other words, I believe you have to start with the 10. And I believe at the end you can manage more than one franchise at scale in a large corporation. You can have a printer business and a storage business and a computer business and a instruments business. But to get it through the knothole, to get from the innovation side of the ledger to the fully established franchise side of the ledger, I'm implying that that's like an hourglass. Oh. And so if you look at what Jobs did at Apple, what's amazing about it was he did those things one at a time. So when he brought on the iPod and the iTunes, you didn't hear a word about the Mac from then on. Not a single advertising dollar did you ever hear about the Macintosh. And then when he got the iTunes iPod thing all the way done, only then did you hear about the iPhone. And once the iPhone came in, you didn't hear another word about the iPod or iTunes ever again either. And interestingly, it turns out we discovered afterwards, he had the iPad arguably before the iPhone, because the iTouch, which was kind of an iPad mini, was sort of an iPod, you know, extension thing. He had it, but he suppressed it. So he did the iPhone until the iPhone got all the way to scale, and then and only then did he introduce the iPad. So that to me, that is the most important lesson. I mean, everything else about Steve Jobs, you think, well, I'm not Steve Jobs. But that's one lesson we can all learn.
Interesting. So in the case of your work now, you know, when you look across, you know, all the books you've written and that, you know, the one that I, you know, most recently that I've read and got dog-eared sitting right here on my desk is Escape Velocity. You know, some of the challenges and the analogies and the stories you tell in that book about what does it really take to, you know, maybe we're not all Steve Jobs, and We don't all we have maybe the starting of a kernel of an idea, but how do you really get that thing to take off? So anything new in your thinking on that space, or things that
yeah,
you got?
Yeah, you know, I think for a long time we thought, first of all, everybody looking at this problem said, boy, the odds of success are not great. And so I think where we focused for a very long time, and I focused on the prior book called Dealing with Darwin, which is an innovation book, is how you and I got connected last time. I thought, well, what you have to do is you better have a super white hot, incredibly intense innovation, because most of these things are going to peter out. And so maybe if we get this thing, you know, sort of like lithium, cadmium, you know, glowing, you know, just like in searing heat, maybe we can get all the way through the antibody problem going forward. I now actually think differently. I now actually think if you can actually get the company to align around some of these principles, it almost doesn't matter. I mean, it's got to be a good innovation. It's got to be a very good innovation. But if the company would actually align, if the performance engine would actually reach out constructively, if the innovators would reach out constructively, and if the CEO would shepherd this thing relentlessly, and if the board of directors would give the air cover to the CEO, because you're going to take operating margins down. I mean, one of the problems with innovation is there's a J curve that in the public markets looks terrible. And so you got to get if the entire corporation said, this is the journey that we are going to be on, it actually, I think the odds of success are very high, because you've got a worldwide sales force. You've got a worldwide footprint. You've got a great balance sheet. You can do this stuff. The problem has always been that we've never aligned around it. The sales guys had their comp system, which would put them at odds with the innovator. And by the way, all the other executive vice presidents thought the innovator was just some startup kind of brash person that was wildly overconfident. And the sooner he got taught his lesson, the better. So we never aligned around this stuff. And so getting the entire corporation genuinely aligned around the launch of this new business, I actually think that the odds should be very high instead of very low.
So how important is culture in these organizations, the organizations that you've been involved in? You got a CEO, you've got the innovators, you've got these organizational inertia challenges. How important is it really the CEO, but is it also, what role does the culture make as far as bringing that
together? Well, it's huge. If you have a political, you know, large organizations over time tend to develop a kind of a political culture and somewhat of a cynical culture. That is death. So in other words, if the culture cannot put itself in service to something larger than its own personal gratification and personal self-advancement, if it can't put itself in service to a greater cause, then I don't think you can make this work, because this does take self-sacrifice. And normally, the cultures that are most successful at doing this really do believe that they have a mission. And it's a mission that transcends even the company itself. So they're in service to the world, they're in service to a technology, they're in service to a set of customers, they're in service to a cause. But it's not just making money. And the making money will come from this. But money funds the cause. It is not the cause. Those companies, I think, can find a way to come together and unite behind one of these amazing journeys. If your company, however, has become distrustful and skeptical of itself and cynical, and kind of, if you see a lot of Dilbert cartoons on, you know, that are hung on people's cubicles, it's just never going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one thing I've learned over my career, and actually in my last role, really getting indoctrinated into a very, very strong culture was really an eye-opener for me on what the role of culture can play. One of the things, you know,
well, interestingly, by the way, let me make a comment about that, because I think HP's culture went from perhaps, well, when I came to the Valley in the 80s, every startup I ever talked to wanted to have a culture like HP's. And by the time you got to this last 10 years, by the time it had gone through a series of really rather painful executive things, the board, frankly, had behaved very badly, very publicly. There was an enormous amount of turmoil and transition at the top. The culture in that model, it kind of retreats and it protects itself, but it actually gets to a bad place where it's very hard to sponsor the next. I mean, Meg's got a real challenge. there's still that wonderful spark at the core of HB culture, but once the culture starts getting kind of beaten down and sort of cynical, and I think Marissa has the same problem at Yahoo. There was this era of optimism is replaced with either pessimism or cynicism. Man, that's a tough thing to come back from.
Yes, and particularly when you're the innovator inside that storm, trying to navigate next thing.
I think realistically you have to say this is not the place where this is going to happen. Yeah. You can still maintain the old franchises and you can make them more economical, you can make them more efficient, but the notion that this is the organization that could make the sacrifice to birth a new franchise, that I just don't think that's a realistic expectation.
So I want to do just a quick transition here on, I follow you on LinkedIn. You and I are friends on LinkedIn, but I also follow you on LinkedIn with regards to your post on that on LinkedIn. You did one last January. Now, I'm going to test your memory here, Jeffrey. You wrote one last January called "The Tide Has Turned," and in it you say, and I'm going to quote, 2013, in my view, will be the first of 5 to 7 very productive years for IT vendors serving the enterprise. And given that a lot of my listeners are in the enterprise space trying to be the innovators, and a lot of them are in the tech field, as you can imagine, do you still stand by that? You think we're in that kind of that early stage of where you think the IT space, the tech space is on kind of a...
I do, and it reminds me of the early 90s, which is the last time we saw this happen. So if you remember in the early 90s, we'd had the PC movement. First of all, we'd had the mainframe going to mini computer, and we had the relational database, and so we had a lot of interesting systems of record developing. And then we had the PC, which is a personal computer, and that was sort of doing office work. And then the early 90s, we said, you know, what if we hooked the PC with up to the back office systems, and we created client server architecture? And all of a sudden, there was a huge productivity explosion. The internet gets overlaid onto that halfway through the decade, and we have the most amazing sort of 10 years of enterprise IT probably in its history. So then we kind of overate at the end of Y2K, and so that kind of, you know, we kind of had to digest that. And in the first decade of this century was clearly a consumer decade. It was all about Facebook, Twitter, Google, Frugal, Moogle, whatever. You know, just keep naming them, right? Uber and OpenTable and all these incredible things for consumers. So that's great. But now you look at in 2013, 2012, all of a sudden we're having the same thing. But the enterprise has said, look, we have this amazing personal computing infrastructure that's based on mobile and it's based on smartphones and tablets and this software as a service and no training and apps and app stores and all this cool stuff. We need to bring that into the enterprise architecture. And for a while it was like, no, you can't do that. It can't be done. It's too the security, blah, blah, blah. But like as before, we've now said, okay, whether it's secure or not, this journey has already started. I believe that investment and the productivity returns of that investment are a decade's worth of work. So I think for the next decade, anybody who is in service to enterprise IT is going to see a lot of money not going into the old systems of record. Those are pretty well established and they're in maintenance mode, but going into what I would call systems of engagement, which overlay on top of the systems of record, let people collaborate and communicate in ways that we never could do before, and frankly be as powerful at work as we are at home. Because right now, when you're a consumer, you're master of the universe right now in the digital world. But at work, you're often still a dweeb. And the idea is, well, why can't we take the same empowering infrastructure and make it part of the enterprise world? And by the way, the enterprise is needing to reach out to the consumer anyway, or they're going to be digitally irrelevant. So there's a lot of money I think is going to go into systems of engagement. I think it's going to create a renaissance around enterprise IT.
So, last question here. You know, you sit as a venture partner at More David Dow. You see a lot of, you know, new companies coming in, pitching to try to raise money. If you were a listener of this podcast, what areas do you find interesting now as a VC?
Well, okay, so the classic cliche, and I think probably it's still, you know, VCs are not that imaginative, so cliches are probably pretty good for us. The classic cliche right now is social, mobile, analytics, and cloud. Sometimes they call it the smack stack, right? But and of those two, I would say social and mobile have gotten a lot of attention, and maybe those cards are a bit overplayed, but there's still a lot of work to do there, particularly in how would you manage them, what's the infrastructure for managing them, how would you create security, those kinds of issues. But analytics and cloud right now are game changers, because what they do, what you realize is people are actually changing business models by saying, if I can actually leverage the data that I learn from the cloud with analytics, I can afford to give away products that other people sell. This is why Google is such a threat to Microsoft. Because Google says, look, I can, whatever Microsoft makes, I will give you. Because if you use it and you let me look at the way you use it, I can monetize that data through my search engine advertising, through better advertising, or some other ideas. I mean, artificial intelligence and machine learning can do a lot of stuff. And so that changes the rules of the game. And you're seeing that happening in advertising. You're seeing it happening in media and television. You're seeing it happening in retail. I think it's going to eventually happen fairly quickly here, hopefully in healthcare. I think education is going to be on the docket next, which is, in every one of these cases, if you could just watch, you know, what students would do online during studying a class, or if you could watch the healthcare or the health habits of a patient population that you insure, couldn't you, you know, be a better insurer and make more money? Couldn't you be a better educational institution and create better education? The answer is, of course you could. So I think this opportunity around the cloud, which creates the infrastructure and the possibility of getting the data all together, so all this stuff about Hadoop and all that kind of stuff, and then the analytics, and then the data scientists who know how to look at the analytics. And by the way, there's still a lot of business invention, because the business models have to be invented. They don't just come with the data. You have to sort of connect the dots. But the opportunity there is just staggering, and I think that's part of this decade of innovation.
Hey, Jeffrey, thank you again for spending the time. And to the listeners, go out and pick out the latest edition of Crossing the Chasm. I've read each of the two previous editions and love the new story. So I'll admit I have not read the new one, so I got to go out and I'll get it this weekend. But I've read it many times, and it helps me just remind me of things that you just kind of, you know, gloss over and forget. It's a great source. And Jeffrey, thanks again for the time. It's always great to catch up.
Well, thank you, Phil. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Killer Innovations Podcast. It's like an electric charge of creativity direct to your brain. Here's an example. Whoa! Ow! With KillerInnovations.com. Our Killer Innovations Podcast, equipping you to create the next killer innovation. I get your point.